I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On Monday, Judge Glenn Berman of New Jersey State Superior Court sentenced former Rutgers University student Darren Ravi to 30 days in jail for spying on his roommate Tyler Clementi having a sexual encounter with a man in their dorm room. Ravi was also ordered to get counseling, perform community service, serve 3 years probation, and pay $10,000 to help victims of bias crimes. Clementi had committed suicide by jumping off the George Washington Bridge in September 2010, just a few days after he learned about what his roommate had done. Earlier this year, a jury had found Ravi guilty of invasion of privacy, evidence tampering, and bias intimidation. He could have been sentenced to a decade in prison and deported. The judge said this yesterday about the most serious charge against Darren Ravi.
I do not believe he hated Tyler Clementi, but I do believe he acted out of colossal insensitivity.
Well, here we have two lawyers to talk about what this verdict and sentencing means and what it does and doesn't say about hate crime and bias intimidation laws. Let me introduce them to you. Heidi Hurd is a professor of law and professor of philosophy, former dean at the University of Illinois. Heidi Hurd, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty.
Michael Lieberman is also with us as well, Washington Counsel for the Anti-Defamation League, also serves as the director of the League's Civil Rights Policy Planning Center. And Michael Lieberman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. Well,
good to be with you, Marty.
Michael, let me begin with you. Was justice served yesterday?
It's such a tragic case. I think that people will have different reactions to it. Facing 10 years for what he did seems excessive, but 30 days feels like a real slap on the wrist.
What would have been more appropriate from your perspective?
Hard to say. I mean, you know, something in between. I mean, for us, it was never really a paradigmatic hate crime case. We were moving on as a teachable moment. This case was not just about two kids, freshmen in a dorm room in Rutgers. It was about so much more for the country. I think the attention that was focused on it was proper. And so the question then for us as an organization that works on preventing bias and preventing hate crime is whether Ravi and his peers thought it was funny and acceptable. Who told them that it was okay to think that? Was there any training that had ever gone on as a high school kid? Were his parents ever involved in any kind of internet teaching of ethics and a code of honor and respect for other people? Those questions loom large for us.
And I want to pick up on all of that, but let me get you in on the conversation, Heidi Hurd. From your perspective, did this punishment fit the crime?
Well, you know, I certainly echo Michael's notion that this, I mean, this is just, it really is a very tragic case, and it's tragic all the way around. But the bias intimidation offense, as it's defined in New Jersey, is a very, very strange formulation of a defense. The jury found he didn't intend to intimidate his roommate. The judge was explicit yesterday in finding no evidence of hatred for him or hatred or bias, particularly towards, towards those with a gay sexual orientation. So 3 years of probation for a hate crime when there was no hate, no bias, and no purpose to intimidate doesn't seem outlandish.
Well, just picking up on that, the fact that he spied on his roommate, spying as he was having a sexual encounter, is that a crime from your perspective, Heidi?
Certainly the jury found him guilty of invasion of privacy, a crime defined under the law of the state. This particular crime, the bias intimidation crime, is a lot like the criminalization of the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress. And if it were so formulated, it wouldn't have anything to do with hate or bias based on group membership. We would think it tragically cruel for somebody to do this to anybody for any reason.
Let me just pick up on that. I mean, from your perspective, to make this a hate crime, it would have to send a message to other gay students or gays and lesbians that, you know, we could spy on you as well?
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, to make it a hate crime under any given state's law, it depends on whether it satisfies the formulation of the state statute. And statutes are written very, very differently, all under the rubric of hate and bias crimes. Some require a true finding by the jury of hatred or bias based on group membership. Others simply require that the victim be targeted as a result of group membership. Mm-hmm. This statute for bias intimidation under which Ravi was convicted doesn't even require either any of that. It's enough that the victim reasonably perceives that he was targeted because, in this case, of his sexual orientation. Not that the defendant had the purpose to so intimidate or even particularly knew that he would be so intimidated. So that's why, in this case, the jury can explicitly find that there was no purpose to intimidate on the basis of his roommate's sexual orientation, and yet he can be held liable criminally for the crime of intimidation.
Well, let me pick up on that and go back to you, Michael Lieberman. Based on what Heidi Hurd said, that if a victim perceives that they are being targeted or even feel intimidated, but the perpetrator didn't intend that, whose judgment prevails?
Yeah, I think that Heidi has accurately illustrated a couple different problems with the fact that the 45 states and District of Columbia that have hate crime laws are all different. Mm-hmm. The federal government also has a regime of federal criminal civil rights statutes, and the standards are different. But basically, we should not get caught up in the vagaries of individual different laws. The Supreme Court in 1993, in the best kind of Supreme Court decision, unanimous, short, not very many footnotes, written by the Chief Justice, said these types of penalty enhancement statutes, and that's what we have in New Jersey, are constitutional and they make sense from a public policy standpoint. Intentional selection of the victim on the basis of a personal characteristic is the basic frame and trigger that we look at with hate crime laws. And I think a question in the Ravi Tyler Clemente case is, would he have acted exactly the same if it was a heterosexual relationship, or was he treating his roommate differently because he was gay?
Well, we don't know the answer to that, do we?
We do not, but I think there's a few assumptions that can be drawn about Ravi's views on gays from the texts and an enormous amount of information that has come out that frames the discussion.
Well, and one can pull various texts out, both in and out of context. I have one here where he says to Tyler Clemente, "I've known you were gay and I have no problem with it. I don't want your freshman year to be ruined because of a petty misunderstanding." And I guess in trying to understand what the thinking was behind this particular act, you know, you can find, it seems to me, you can find tweets and texts that can take you in two different directions, Michael.
There's no doubt about it. When we look at this case, it is not a paradigmatic hate crime case. Right. Most hate crime cases, and the FBI told us last year that there were something like 6,600 hate crimes reported by local law enforcement to the FBI around the country in 2010, which is the most recent data. Most of the hate crime cases that are reported scream their bias. People do not burn parallelograms on the front lawn of black families that just moved into the neighborhood. No one would know what the charred remains of a parallelogram mean, but everybody knows what a cross on a burning cross in the middle of the night means on the front lawn of a black family that just moved into the neighborhood. It's terrorism. These are message crimes, and they should be dealt with quite significantly, we believe.
Heidi Hurd, let me go back to you, and we could get deep into the law in New Jersey, which might be complicated, might be helpful, might not. But I'm wondering, using this particular case, whether the court is saying that spying is an invasion of privacy, that in and of itself is a hate crime or it results in bias intimidation.
Yeah, that would be an odd thing to say if that's what the judge were saying. And of course, the judge didn't actually reference the invasion of privacy as the principal basis of either of the sets of sentences, as it were. He gave 30 days for witness and evidence tampering and lying to the police, 3 years probation for the bias intimidation. The invasion of privacy upon which that piggybacks is that, you know, one can invade people's privacy in all sorts of ways and for all sorts of reasons, that have absolutely nothing to do with their identity, racial, ethnic, religious, sexual orientation, and so forth. So one wouldn't want to say that in all invasions of privacy constitute instances of you know, bias, intimidation.
But should there be protected classes in this country, individuals who could be or have been the targets of intimidation, and that should be a protected class? I do.
Well, that's to say that being repeatedly offended against is a sufficient unique concern to the criminal justice system that we ought to ratchet up penalties for repeat victimization. And that sounds right to me.
Right.
It's surely worse to be, you know, a repeat victim than, you know, a sort of one-time victim. The problem with this is that we're using group membership to capture the likelihood of repeated victimization. And you have to ask yourself whether that's a good proxy. In some communities, it doesn't seem like a crazy proxy, but there's, of course, an alternative way of doing that, and that is that if a defendant has the bad fortune of having picked a victim who's been victimized repeatedly before, that could be a basis of aggravated penalty, just because we think that people shouldn't have to suffer repeat victimization. It's quite different to say that classes of people ought to be, you know, afforded a sort of unique protection under the criminal law because the class is disproportionately targeted.
But that's not the way hate crime statutes work
at all. Go ahead,
Michael.
Go ahead.
The way they work are they're triggered in almost every case, and in New Jersey as well, by language like action, conduct that was precipitated because of, and then there is a long list, longer in some states, shorter in other states, of categories. But the categories are all-inclusive. The hate crime issue is a colorblind issue. A black person targeting a white person would be a hate crime if it was intentionally selected because of race. Same with a gay person targeting a heterosexual. They are colorblind statutes, and they work exactly like Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. You can hire someone or fail to hire someone or fire someone in this country for any reason at all, except for reasons that Congress or state legislatures or local ordinances tell you are unacceptable reasons. And those include race, religion, sexual orientation in some cases, national origin. Those are categories where society says law shapes attitudes. And we are not going to permit people to be hired and fired on the basis of race and religion. We are not going to be able to We are not going to tolerate people being intentionally selected for violence on the basis of who they are.
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Michael Lieberman, Washington Counsel for the Anti-Defamation League. Also with us is Heidi Hurd, Professor of Law and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Illinois, and both of them joining us today in Radio Times as we get both reaction to the sentencing yesterday of Darwin Ravi, and also leads us to a discussion about bias, intimidation, hate crime laws. We're opening up the phones for your questions and comments. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Cooper Heart Valve Center supports WHYY. Aortic valve stenosis affects nearly 300,000 people annually. Cooper is the first hospital in South Jersey offering a new non-surgical valve repair, the Sapien Heart Valve. This FDA-approved technology offers a treatment option for patients unable to undergo valve surgery and is expected to transform the treatment of aortic valve disease. More at 800-8-COOPER or cooperhealth.org/sapien.
Bring your appetite, food fanatics, as WHYY celebrates some of the region's greatest culinary minds with Best of the Chefs, a two-hour tasting featuring an array of area restaurants, breweries, and businesses. They'll serve up their tastiest treats, and your votes decide who is crowned Best of the Chefs in several mouth-watering categories. Also, a raffle, beer garden, and live music. Thursday, June 21st. Tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
The Violette DeMazia Foundation supports WHYY. Registration is now open for the Violette DeMazia Foundation Summer Art Appreciation Programs at the Abington Arts Center and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Plus, their new Fountains of Philadelphia walking tour is being offered for those interested in discovering outdoor art. Classes are appropriate for anyone interested in discovering a different way to see art and life. Registration at www.demazia.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking about yesterday's decision by Judge Glenn Berman of New Jersey's State Superior Court. He sentenced former Rutgers University student Darwin Ravi to 30 days in jail, also ordered to get counseling, perform community service, serve 3 years probation, and pay $10,000 to help victims of bias crimes. And Darwin Ravi had been convicted earlier this year of invasion of privacy, evidence tampering, and bias intimidation. And this was for spying on his former roommate, Tyler Clementi, who sadly committed suicide just a couple days after learning what his roommate had done by jumping off the George Washington Bridge. And we are talking about all of this with Heidi Hurd and with Michael Lieberman. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Heidi Hurd, from your perspective, if we're talking about bias, intimidation, or hate crimes, does there have to be violence in order for that to stick, essentially?
Well, I wouldn't think so, and there's nothing in the statute that suggests that. I know that the judge certainly referenced that as a basis for giving probation to Ravi, but certainly bias and hate crimes are written without that being a criterion as a general matter.
As a general matter, for you, Michael Lieberman, is it important that there be some kind of violence?
Well, the United States system is entirely different than basically every country that we think of as free. Many, many other countries, England, Canada, Australia, Belgium, France, Germany, punish hate speech. We do not. There is a broad protection of First Amendment speech, but that's not what we're talking about in a hate crime context. Hate crime laws do not punish speech. They require conduct. And in some cases, Marty, that conduct will be violent conduct. Mm-hmm. I think that's the paradigmatic example. A tire iron to the head of someone who is a different in your neighborhood, who you think should not be in your neighborhood because of their color or national origin. That is a much more paradigmatic case. And I think the judge in this case, coming back to the Ravi trial, looked at the cases that had been sentenced under New Jersey law, looked at Ravi as a kid, nonviolent offender, first-time offender, and that definitely played into a 30-day sentence.
Heidi, are you concerned that some of these hate crime laws would impact an individual's First Amendment rights?
I think, you know, when they were first crafted, there was a great deal of attention to the intersection with First Amendment protection. The law has sort of worked out or negotiated that relationship over the past decades, and so I don't know that there's concern, or I certainly wouldn't have concern about hate crime laws based on that, based on the worry that it would blur into the protection of speech. But I may not be as ferocious a First Amendment advocate as some are, or as I ought to be. My worries about hate crime legislation stem from other sources, one of which was referenced by Michael when we started. With all due respect, I have so much respect for you, Michael. I'm thrilled to be talking with you on this program.
That's nice, Heidi.
But you started by suggesting that this was hopefully going to be a teachable moment, and that the sentence delivered in the Ravi case would send the kind of message that would ultimately aid the mission of your organization, which is to prevent crime, and in particular prevent, in this kind of a case, crime predicated on sexual orientation. I guess, as a criminal law scholar, I don't think of the criminal law as first and foremost being in the teachable moment position, in the prevention business. I think of it as delivering up just desserts in proportion to the blameworthiness of what people have done. And so I am very wary about ever using the criminal law to send messages and become a tool of education, just because sometimes the punishment we would want to inflict or would need to inflict in order to educate others about their obligations would be disproportionate to what is deserved in an individual case. You know, parents don't do that with their kids. It's a very unfortunate thing when a parent would punish one child as a way of educating another.
Well, let me pick up on that. And Michael Lieberman, let me give you a chance to respond.
Well, I think the concept behind hate crime laws is that these crimes are different. We don't have to go to the question about whether they are more serious, more impactful. But we definitely know that these crimes are different from other crimes. There is a special emotional and psychological impact to them. It's unusual for the civil rights community to partner with the law enforcement community on trying to get more police authority on a particular issue, but that's exactly what happened for 13 years in trying to get the most important new federal hate crime law, the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act, passed in October of 2009. Every major law enforcement organization in the country came to support the act, with every significant religious, educational, civil rights organization. And the reason was because both law enforcement and civil rights organizations understand that these crimes have a unique impact and that something must be done to address them in a significant and serious way.
Well, let me just pick up on that, because those were both horrendous crimes. Matthew Shepard lashed to a fence, died 4 days after he was discovered. Someone thought he looked like a scarecrow. He'd been so beaten up. Byrd had been dragged behind a car in Texas. And I mean, seems to me, Michael, those are just egregious crimes.
Horrible crimes. But if you look at the patchwork of state hate crime statutes before the enactment of the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act, right, you saw a series of laws that had gaps. And so the federal government, we believed, in leading the coalition to get this law passed, needs to have backstop authority. Rare but important. The federal government can step in when state and locals can't or won't. Matthew Shepard's murderers were prosecuted effectively. It would not have mattered if there was a hate crime statute to enhance what they could have gotten, which was death penalty. Mm-hmm. Same with the murderers of James Byrd Jr. But it's a very, very important, and I guess Heidi, as a philosopher and law scholar, would agree, to be able to call a crime what it is. And in Matthew Shepard's case, there's no doubt that he was killed because he was gay. And since Wyoming did not have, and still does not have, a hate crime statute, it could not be called that.
Well, and I don't mean to be too legalistic here, and believe me, I'm not a lawyer, but to you, Heidi Heard, I get the feeling, though, and Michael was talking about the fact that there have been some more than 6,000, cases involving charges of hate crimes, there's the chance it could be overused and in a sense, either be used against an individual in an unfair kind of way, or overused to the point where we don't know what it means anymore.
I don't know. I never worry too much about overuse, in the sense that if people are properly punished for certain things because those deeds are either more harmful or committed with uniquely serious culpability, I'm not going to worry that we're going to have to sort of, as it were, build more prisons. Mm-hmm. That is, we shouldn't not criminalize things because there'd be too many of them.
Right.
So I don't know that it's a concern about overuse. The concern that I've expressed is a worry about using individuals as vehicles for affecting the behavior of others, using them, using their liberty, as it were, as a way of sort of demonstrating the seriousness of a social problem to others so that we could affect others' behavior. It's always a worry to use a single individual in this way rather than to respond uniquely to that person's deed and relative culpability.
Let me quote something from the acting ADL New Jersey regional director, and Etzion Neuer saying that the law is a blunt instrument when addressing these issues. This is talking about yesterday's sentencing. The systemic problems of prejudice and bullying are best addressed through comprehensive anti-bias education in school, at home, in religious and community settings. Everywhere we educate children to be socially and emotionally productive. And Michael Lieberman, he seems to be saying that the court is not the place to in a sense, sort of argue these particular issues. We need to educate ourselves and each other about bias and bullying.
We definitely believe that, Marty. And Etsy is right that the law is a blunt instrument. I have been working on hate crime laws, and the Anti-Defamation League wrote the first model hate crime law in 1981. But however much we believe in the deterrent and preventative impact of these laws and the important message-sending aspect about them, they are blunt instruments. It is much better to prevent the crime in the first place. That's why I'm really, really glad that the Anti-Defamation League also works on education and prevention programs. That's really where the plurality and focus of our budget goes, to prevent these crimes from occurring in the first place. And with regard to the question about overuse mm-hmm. or abuse of these statutes, mm-hmm. we have 40 years of federal laws, 30 years of state and local laws, and there just have been very, very, very few instances of even puzzling use of these statutes, and that is very comforting to the folks that have been supporting them actively.
And that's Michael Lieberman, Washington Counsel for the Anti-Defamation League, also serves as the director of the League's Civil Rights Policy Planning Center. Also with us, Heidi Heard, professor of law and philosophy, former dean at the University of Illinois. We are talking about bias and intimidation, hate crime laws, and yesterday's sentencing of former Rutgers University student Darun Ravi. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Liz from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Liz, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a mental health advocate and a journalist who's been writing about mental health issues for a long time, and I've worked in social services. And one thing about this case that I think is very interesting is the fact that we wouldn't even be having this conversation if it weren't for the fact that Tyler Clementi committed suicide. And, you know, I think obviously the legal questions are key here, especially with the sentencing. But I think it raises a couple of important mental health issues that are kind of being skirted at this point. One of those is, can a person's actions induce another to kill himself? And the other is that what happened here? In other words, was Tyler Clementi prompted to kill himself as a result of this webcam instance? And I think it's important to ask these questions because there have been people saying, and I'm sure this will come up again with the appeals, there have been people saying that, you know, well, you know, Ravi needs to be made an example of because what happened was, in fact, an act of violence, although he didn't do the violence directly. Clementi killed himself because of Ravi's actions. As somebody,
you know what, Liz, if you don't mind, let me just take your point because it's an important one, and it also, I mean, we're talking about the law, so it gets a little cold and legalistic, but let me give Heidi Heard a chance to weigh in on that. The court, this was not a murder case, so it's not as if Darun Ravi was accused of being responsible for Tyler Clementi's sad suicide. Heidi?
Right. It was the case he wasn't charged with the homicide precisely because he couldn't be under our law, and probably rightly so. People who make free choices about their own fate ultimately do what we call severing the causal chain. When Tyler chose to jump off that bridge, he was sufficiently autonomous with regard to that choice under the eyes of the law that he broke the causal chain, otherwise extending back to Ravi. And that's a basis for not being able to hold Ravi as a principal in any sort of a homicide prosecution. The question, of course, is, well, how autonomous was he? He certainly was responding. It seems, to what Robbie had done, but not in a way that suggested a loss of autonomy of the sort that the criminal law would, you know, would say didn't constitute a free, voluntary, intervening act.
Mike, you want to weigh in on this?
Well, we'll never know, really, what caused Tyler Clementi to jump off the bridge. And I think that, I don't think there's any doubt that this case got the attention that it got, and maybe the prosecutorial attention as well, because of what happened after these events that were, you know, whatever Robbie thought he was doing. I'm sure that he did not intend to cause his roommate to commit suicide, but that is one of the ways to look at this case, that there was a connection, although clearly not a legal connection, that could be charged for murder.
I mean, there's no, Liz, thanks for the call to Radio Times. There's no way of knowing that if Tyler Clementi hadn't done this, whether this would have ended up in a courtroom. Have you thought about that, Michael?
We have thought about that. I think that there's really no way to know. And I think we started by saying this is not a paradigmatic case. I think the cases that go to trial in hate crime contexts are really not nuanced cases, not where you have people, you know, kind of wondering, you know, really, was this a hate crime? Was this not a hate crime? They really do scream their bias in the vast majority of cases that actually go to trial.
Heidi, you wrote a paper, more than a decade ago in 2001, titled Why Liberals Should Hate Hate Crime Legislation. Do you still stand by that?
Well, my particular concern with hate crime legislation is precisely that it is targeting motivations or dispositional states, as they say, character traits, for punishment. We punish the underlying criminal deed, say invasion of privacy, and we punish the purpose that accompanies that deed as a standard matter in criminal law. What hate crime legislation does with its enhanced penalty is target the background motivation with which the person purposely did the otherwise criminalized deed. And to punish people for hatred or bias is to punish them for dispositions that they can't at the moment choose not to have. They can choose not to throw the rock through the synagogue window, but they can't choose at that moment not to have the prejudice that is motivating them.
Let me just stop you there. We're almost up on a break here, but are you saying that these laws are used to punish people for their belief systems?
Effectively, yeah. Beliefs, dispositions, emotional attributes. That's what hatred and bias towards groups are. And I think, you know, we have every reason to morally condemn people for being bigots and racists and homophobes. But the law is a blunt instrument, as Michael rightly said, and to punish people for those beliefs and for those emotional states that accompany criminal behavior is to punish people for things that they don't at the moment have autonomous control about.
Let's take a very short break. I'm sure, Michael, you want to respond to that.
Heidi
Herd and Michael Lieberman, our guests today on Radio Times. We're talking about a wide range of things, everything from bias, intimidation, hate crime laws, also the sentencing yesterday of former Rutgers University student Darwin Ravi, sentenced to 30 days in prison for crimes in connection with his roommate Tyler Clementi, whom he spied upon. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Inquirer supports WHYY. Every day, the Inquirer features stories about the people, the government, and the happenings of the Philadelphia region and beyond. Plus, augmented reality content every Sunday. The Inquirer. Your life. Your stories.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. On view now through June 3rd. The 111th Annual Student Exhibition features over 1,000 works of art by PAFA's BFA, Certificate, and MFA students. The Annual Student Exhibition showcases a diversity of style, combining traditional skill and contemporary vision. For details, 215-972-7600 or online at pafa.edu.
Hey everybody, Jad here. I wanted to let you know that Radiolab is coming soon to Philadelphia for a live show. We're calling it In the Dark, and it's all about darkness and light, seeing, believing. It's going to be a super fun night because we've got the comedian Dimitri Martin coming with us, the singer-songwriter Tao Nguyen, and the amazing dance troupe Palabolas. They'll all be there. We'll be there June 29th at the Academy of Music. You can get tickets at radiolab.org.
The Wildwoods present a Celebration of Heroes Festival May 25th through the 27th, paying tribute to America's military, veterans, and first responders. Information at wildwoodsnj.com/heroes. The Wildwoods support WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Are hate crime laws fair and necessary? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. A few open lines. Michael Lieberman, Washington Counsel for the Anti-Defamation League, is our guest, along with Heidi Hurd. She's a professor of law and philosophy, former dean at the University of Illinois. Michael, I know you want to respond to what Heidi was saying before the break about using these laws to essentially prosecute people for their beliefs and emotions.
Yes, I am an admirer of Heidi's really thoughtful work on hate crime laws and how they work philosophically. But your question to her is the proper one. Does she still believe it? The work that she did in 1999 and congressional testimony 2001 with this article, because I think what we have is an opportunity to see like what has happened. The idea that an individual is punished because of their beliefs is demonstrably untrue. You have to commit a crime. So whatever beliefs you have, nothing happens in the criminal law until there is an underlying predicate crime. And then there might be the trigger of an enhanced penalty. And the idea, this I've never understood, Heidi, the idea that you cannot control yourself. You have a certain hatred or bigotry, and then you can't control yourself, and so the law should not take that into account. I guess we feel exactly the opposite. The reason why a kid in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, is less likely to try and target a Mexican immigrant who's walking through the park with a family member, and then maybe they heard about the federal prosecution, serious federal hate crime prosecution of kids that targeted a person who looked differently from them in a park in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, and they got serious criminal penalties associated with it. These crimes, we believe, have a deterrent impact. When you open up the paper, you may hate African Americans, but whether you're going to act against one who moves into your neighborhood may depend in part on whether you think you can commit a crime and no one will care, and that's what hate crime laws are designed to address. Significantly demonstrate that society does care about these crimes and will treat them seriously.
Just a quick response, Heidi, if you don't mind, then we'll get back to our callers.
You bet. So lots in there. First, I certainly think people can control themselves. They can control their behavior. So when somebody decides to assault somebody who's an African American, I fully believe they can control themselves in the sense that they can choose otherwise. Can they at that moment purge themselves of the hatred that accompanies their choice in action? I don't know. Try willing yourself to like somebody. I bet you can't do it. Try willing yourself to have beliefs other than you have. I bet you can't do it. People spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in therapy every year trying to change themselves for the better, precisely because changing yourself takes indirect means, like therapy, to accomplish it. You can't simply will away emotions and beliefs. And it's because hate crime legislation targets emotions and beliefs that accompany chosen behavior that those crimes are suspect.
But it has to be behavior, though, actions, does it not, Heidi, in order
absolutely.
For someone?
Absolutely, okay. And those are already criminalized. So take aggravated assault under the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994 at the federal level. Aggravated assault that isn't accompanied by hatred or bias gets a base level offense score of 15, gets you 18 months. If it's committed with hatred or bias, essentially, it can get you 33 months. The difference between 18 months and 33 months is the difference of hatred or bias.
But what you're forgetting,
there's coercive action and there's intentional action. That's already criminalized. The additional or enhanced penalty is for the hatred or bias, and the hatred or bias is what is not susceptible to immediate will.
Okay, Michael, quick response,
sure.
If you don't mind, then we'll
Heidi,
get to
I think what you're disregarding is that in the vast majority of these cases, nothing would happen but for the bias. So what you have is bias that prompts conduct. It's not like there's conduct and then how do you disaggregate the emotions. It's the emotions and the prejudice that you have, and nothing happens until there's conduct, violence,
right. Now, that's
some
actually
action.
Really, really important, because then that's to say, well, think about other crimes. There's always a reason for a crime, or it wouldn't happen. Jealousy, sadism, greed. There's always a reason, and we haven't gotten into the business of criminalizing people's reasons until now. And then you have to ask yourself, is hatred and bias worse than sadism or greed or jealousy? And if not, then these laws are arbitrary because they're picking out for special punishment a class of motivations within a larger class of equally vicious motivations.
Well, and I hate to do this to our callers. Go ahead, Michael, then we will get to our callers.
Well, there's a paradigm that I think our society uses, and that is a societal frame that things that happen on the basis of personal characteristics, race, religion, are odious. We're going to punish them in a workplace context. That's Title VII. We're not going to let you do whatever you want on the basis of race. You know, maybe greed or jealousy might be a reason to hire or fire someone, but you can't hire or fire someone on the basis of race. And the same in the criminal context. The law is a teacher. As I know you know that as dean. Maybe you taught that as dean and as a professor now. And the idea that the criminal law can be a teacher matters to us as well.
Let me get Michael from Washington Square to join our conversation. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for taking my call, Marty.
Sure.
Professor Hurd, I was at Penn Law when you were there. I did criminal law under Steve Morse and, more importantly, a seminar under Matt Piven. And so I think you'll understand my question. I want to hear your thoughts about the nexus between hate crime laws in general and society's need for retribution. And do you think that it's appropriate given society's need for retribution?
Fair enough. Michael, thanks for calling in. Thanks for your patience as well. Heidi, go ahead.
Well, there are two bases upon which somebody deserves punishment. Either they've done a deed that is uniquely harmful, or they've done it an already existing crime with sufficiently special culpability that we'd want to define a separate crime, right? So the question about hate crimes or bias crimes is, one, whether they, in fact, work special harms, and Michael Lieberman's position is that they do, or they don't work special harms, but hatred or bias constitute particularly heinous types of culpability. And my previous challenge just a minute ago was about whether hatred or bias constitute uniquely culpable mental states separate from sadism or revenge or greed or jealousy. I'm going to give Michael his claim that victims of hate crimes experience unique psychological trauma and that makes them more harmful. I have doubts about whether or not we should be, you know, punishing people or enhancing the penalties of crimes when people can't, in fact, will away at the time of action the reason for their action in the same way that they can will their actions directly.
Michael, let me just ask you another question. Looking at this Darren Ravi case and the sentencing and what he's been accused of, do you think his actions, though, sent a message to, let's say, other gay students that you are essentially at, because you are, you know, part of this, you are gay, like Tyler Clementi, that you are a potential target?
I think that his actions reflected insensitivity, and the judge said it yesterday, to sexual orientation issues. It's uncomfortable. It was awkward for him. I think there's reams of evidence that it was awkward, weird, funny, strange. And I think that we have an opportunity as a society to teach that there are many different kinds of people, many different kinds of families. It's very, very important to normalize the experience that different kinds of people have. And I think that he thought that it was okay to treat Tyler differently because he was gay. I definitely think that was one of the reasons why he thought it would be so funny, so titillating, so interesting to others to turn on his webcam for this encounter.
But and excuse my English here, but is he equally accused of being a jerk?
Yeah, I think he's equally accused of being a jerk. I mean, there are college freshmen all around the country that are looking at this story and saying, but for the grace of God, go I. I think this is the kind of behavior that is totally unacceptable, and we need to make sure that people understand that it's totally unacceptable.
And I just have to say, there are things in my past that I wish I had never done. I will just say that. Let me give Henry from Cape May a chance to join our conversation. Henry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I'm just intrigued by the fact that much has been made of the attitude of the defendant, both before and after this incident, up to the time of the sentencing. I think the judge referred to that in his comments. One of the things I understand was on the table was deportation. And I wondered what would have been the reaction had the judge simply said, "You're not the kind of person we want in this country," and ordered deportation. And I wonder what your panelists would think if that had been the sentence. I'll hang up and
me too, Henry. I appreciate the call. Heidi Heard, do you want to take that?
Well, I think it's tempting for all of us to say we don't want jerks in the country. to put together your previous question,
yes,
with this thoughtful question from this caller. But, of course, the question is whether the criminal law should be the litmus test for jerkiness or the litmus test for membership in our citizenry. I don't do immigration law. I can't speak to the conditions of deportation. But I can't speculate.
Yeah.
But it's a federal question, of course. I mean,
yes,
the state court judge was not empowered to be able to deport or not deport,
right,
Ravi. It's now he's now deportable, and the question is whether the government will want him to be deported.
Thanks for calling in. Let's see what Paul from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. And Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi.
Marty.
You're welcome.
I guess, first of all, I just have to say, to me, this is really complicated.
It is really
just
complicated.
Just hate crimes in general. In the context of Anders Breivik, the Norwegian mass killer,
oh, yes,
in the context of the history, the past of the Holocaust, and what this country was guilty of for several hundred years, it seems like there is a special class of crimes that has to be recognized. And I also have to say that no one forced Clementi to jump off the bridge. He could have said, "I'm here, I'm gay, deal with it." And Ravi, his greatest guilt was just lack of remorse. He seems to be just a shallow person. And that's my whole comment about it. Please say what you will. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul, for calling into Radio Times. Michael Lieberman, if I can toss that to you, and he referenced the Holocaust there.
Sure.
And I'd be curious about what you say in response.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I want to pick up on the special class of crimes and the way law enforcement addresses that. The FBI publishes the Encyclopedia of Crime Data every year. It's called Crime in the United States. And they factor out of that 500-page, if you would print it, it's online, document exactly two kinds of crimes. Law enforcement officers killed in the line of duty, obviously very important to society.
Right.
And the other category that they factor out is hate crime. And I think they understand that something is going on here that is notable and important. The FBI data tells us that the most frequent hate crime victims are African Americans. Race is the most frequent category of hate crime. Second is religion. Very disturbing to someone who works for the Anti-Defamation League, and I bet to your listeners too, 70% of the religion crimes are anti-Jewish crimes. Very disturbing. And the third most frequent hate crimes over the past years has been on the basis of sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm.
So these classes of crimes are very special and impactful and need to be significantly addressed.
And Heidi, here we're almost out of time here, but they are often described as message crimes, that they send a message to a wider community.
That's the going claim. And when Eric Holder, then Deputy Attorney General, was testifying back on the panel I was on a number of years ago, he said, when a black man is harmed, I am harmed. When a black man is made to suffer, I am made to suffer. There is this notion that they ripple out and victimize others. You have to ask whether, A, that's true, and, B, that isn't a failure of empathy on our part if we feel uniquely victimized only when we identify particularly closely with people in a group that we share membership in. One would hope that in the long run, when the bell tolls, it'll toll for all of us.
You're saying that we should identify with all victims of crime, not just the ones that are like us.
Right.
Michael?
Well, we should, but, you know, we kind of don't. And I think that one of the reasons that law enforcement has been an ally of the civil rights community on effective response to hate violence has been they don't want to have riots, and they don't want to have vigilante justice. And if you were African-American and you were the victim of a crime and police were ignoring it, then maybe the African-American, your neighbors, would take up baseball bats and set up their own kind of guard, or in a Jewish neighborhood the same, or sexual orientation. Maybe people would think that gay people should go packing, carry arms, and you're not going to attack a gay person if they're packing, if everybody knows that gay people are packing. So I think law enforcement understands that you don't want this kind of tribal vigilante justice. It's much better to punish within the frame of the criminal law, and that's the reason that police have been so strong against these acts of violence.
Well, Michael Lieberman, Heidi Heard, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. A very interesting discussion.
Thank you.
And Michael Lieberman, Washington Counsel for the Anti-Defamation League, Heidi Heard, Professor of Law and Philosophy, former Dean at the University of Illinois. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, much more. I'm Marty Moscowane. Stay with us. We've got another hour waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.